From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, former Governor James Blanchard reflects on politics in 2017.
The whole cable TV combative atmosphere has resulted in each side demonizing the other, and people willing to believe the worst of the other side.
The hidden company that may soon control the pot industry.
They have three utility patents that cover what one pot geneticist estimated is one half to two thirds of the strains currently on the market.
He lost his son Chase to suicide. Now a dad takes suicide prevention message to students all over Michigan.
But then I asked them, what don't you notice? What don't you see? What they don't see is that I'm a father with a broken heart, that I have a Chase-sized hole inside of me.
Those stories and more on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Of the Democrats who have entered the race for governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer is viewed by many as a front runner. And now the former Senate minority leader is being endorsed by the former governor of Michigan. And the Honorable James Blanchard is here with us now. Mr. Blanchard, it's a pleasure to welcome you.
Well, thank you, Cynthia.
There are several Democratic candidates for governor. Why are you endorsing Gretchen Whitmer over, let's say, Abdul Al-Sayed, who's positioning himself as a more progressive candidate?
Well, I can tell you that Gretchen has the experience to make Michigan work again. She's produced results, for example, playing a key role in providing health care by helping lead the effort to expand Medicaid. She knows how things work, can work across the aisle. She's good on public education, on jobs. She's been a fighter. She led the way to raise the minimum wage. She's good on infrastructure. That's why the building trades have endorsed her. So she has the right stuff. She's strong. She's tough. She's just a great Michigan product, as we say. She will give us a new spirit, really, in Lansing, a new energy. And I think I'm just excited about her candidacy.
You were governor of Michigan from 1983 to 1991. What changes that came after your tenure do you think have had the biggest impact or change on our state?
We are a different state, and the financial crisis of 2008 really hurt us far more than anywhere else. We're lucky that Barack Obama moved in to save Chrysler and General Motors and indirectly all the auto and manufacturing production, because otherwise we'd be nowhere. But we are a different state. We have not taken care of our assets. We have taken our state, our institutions, our assets for granted, whether it's the cost of college, which has skyrocketed, or our crumbling infrastructure. We just haven't been good to ourselves. I think we've lowered expectations. I think there has been a frame of mind that if we can lower wages and lower benefits, somehow our businesses will do better. And, of course, what you end up with is we have fallen from average incomes being above the national average when I served to now below the national average, which is a terrible trend. We need to reverse that. We need someone that's going to fight for good jobs and wages, and I think Gretchen Whitmer will do that.
What about political atmosphere from when you were governor and where we are today? And I guess I mean by that a sense of bipartisan cooperation.
Well, we don't have much of it anymore. That's a real tragedy. I'm used to trying to work across the aisle. When I was in the U.S. Congress, I rarely introduced a bill that didn't have a Republican co-sponsor. As a practical matter, to get it through, and also I wanted my stuff to have credibility with the constituents I represented. You know, at one point, my margin of reelection was 70%. My economic recovery program in Michigan was supported by my two Republican predecessors, Governor Milliken and Governor Romney. You know, in the recent years, the whole cable TV combative atmosphere has resulted in each side demonizing the other and people willing to believe the worst of the other side. And now you have, of course, fake news. So it's a different media environment, and it's going to be very tough to break through that. I see Gretchen Whitmer being very able to work across the aisle. She has done that. I might add, her mother worked for Democrat Frank Kelly, and her father worked for Republican William Milliken. So she was raised in a household that understands that we need to work together.
Mr. Blanchard, I'd love your thoughts on a couple of issues that kind of run through so many conversations about issues in politics in Michigan: gerrymandering and term limits.
Well, term limits have been a disaster because people who get elected don't have to live with the consequences of what they do. It's been very damaging, and even the proponents of it, including my successor, Governor Engler, agree it's been a big mistake. Plus, people in the legislature, when they get there, they're already thinking about what are they going to run for when they're term limited. So they end up running against each other for a higher office or running against their local officials for a local office. So it breeds a lack of cooperation, not living with the consequences. It breeds friction. So that's been a big mistake. I don't know how we're going to change it. Probably the best way is to extend those terms, because we need people who are knowledgeable in the legislature. By the way, Gretchen served the legislature 14 years, and she's knowledgeable. We need that. A lack of experience really hurts us. The other question you had, not term limits, was what was
gerrymandering.
Yeah, well, that's a real mess. Here you have in Michigan, for example, now I speak as a Democrat, Democratic candidates for Congress get more votes statewide than Republican candidates for Congress. And yet the state is gerrymandered, so Republicans have 9 congressional seats and the Democrats only 5. So that's wrong. It should be pretty close and even, and it isn't. So, yeah, we need some form of nonpartisan, logical way of doing reapportionment. And I know there's a move afoot to do that. We really need to do that. By the way, I think if Gretchen is governor, she can help lead that effort. We need that. And we need Republicans and Democrats to agree on that. And it's hard to do that when somebody has the upper hand.
Former Michigan Governor James Blanchard giving his endorsement to Gretchen Whitmer in the governor's race. We want to thank you so much for speaking with us, Mr. Blanchard.
Cynthia, thank you.
As Michigan wrestles with licensing medical marijuana dispensaries, there's a potentially bigger issue facing the budding cannabis industry. The prospect that someone's trying to build a national monopoly on legal weed. As writer Amanda Chicago Lewis says in her story for GQ, some powerful people are trying to turn their company into the Monsanto of marijuana. Amanda is with us via Skype. Amanda, who and what is this Biotech Institute?
So Biotech Institute is a company that has really no assets other than these very broad patents on the cannabis plant. We're not exactly sure what else they are trying to do and what their long-term motivations are, but all we know is that they have 3 utility patents that cover what one pot geneticist estimated is one-half to two-thirds of the strains currently on the market.
And as you spell out in your story for GQ, these utility patents are a pretty powerful tool. Tell us about them. How do they work?
Yeah, so these are the kind of patents that Big Ag uses to protect not only the genetically modified plants that they spend millions and millions of dollars producing, but also any novel variety of a plant that they can prove to the U.S. Patent and Trade Office. They bred themselves, and farmers essentially need to buy the seeds, pay higher rates for those seeds generally when there's a utility patent because of the intellectual property, and then aren't allowed to replant the seeds that are produced from what they grow. They need to buy them again the next year.
So as you spell out in this piece in GQ, what this could mean to the cannabis industry is mind-blowing.
Yeah, you know, I think similar to what we've seen in the tech industry, if you get in early, you can sort of put rather broad intellectual property claims out there and then see sort of what holds up over time. And I think that's what we're seeing now. But rather than just having an influence perhaps on, you know, the iPhone or little bits of technology that companies are fighting over, this could have really big implications for medicine.
As you talk about turning Biotech Institute into the Monsanto of marijuana, what would that mean on the ground and particularly medical research?
I've been told that utility patents can decrease the genetic diversity of a plant that's available. And right now, the cannabis that is available is very genetically diverse. There are lots of different kinds with lots of different compounds. And we don't really know yet exactly which compounds and which combinations are helpful for which diseases. Though it does seem overwhelmingly clear from anecdotal evidence that there are a lot of really promising medical aspects to this plant. And so if one company controls all of the intellectual property around this plant, it sort of seems like there are going to be fewer varieties available, and they will probably have control over research, which could, you know, just make it more limited, you know, more similar to what we see now with big pharma, right, where like one company has patents over certain kinds of medicine, and then they pay for all of that research and development to figure out what they can develop into a drug. which can, you know, make it sort of lopsided in terms of what a business can control.
And also what consumers may have to pay.
Yeah, absolutely.
How well known is this effort to corner the legal cannabis market?
So the patenting effort was, until this story came out, sort of known by a certain group of insiders in the cannabis community, but was not widely known. There was, about a year ago at a conference, one of these pop geneticists that's been sort of aware of this and freaking out about it for the past year or so presented to maybe 20 to 25 high-level people who run major dispensaries and, you know, have millions of dollars at their disposal. And he tried to present to them to get them to come together to pay for a legal challenge to the patents, right? Because there is a lot of suspicion around whether these are truly novel strains. Since cannabis has been a black market for so long, it's very difficult to say whether something has actually been sold or not before, because drug dealers aren't documenting their wares in the same way that other businesses might. So there was this group of insiders, and they were very concerned about the patents, but nobody wanted to put in any money to help solve the problem. And so talks sort of fell apart immediately, but there was this inner circle that was sort of whispering about this for the past year or so. Now, because of the story, it's much more widely known. I think there's sort of waves of fear and concern percolating through the industry.
And bottom line, the last few seconds we have, do we know who is behind the Biotech Institute?
Yes, there is a lawyer in Los Angeles who is definitely part of it. But other than that, who else is paying for it and what their motivations are, we're not exactly sure. So it's sort of obfuscated and difficult to say.
It's quite the detective story. Amanda Chicago Lewis's piece, The Great Pot Monopoly Mystery. You'll find it in the September issue of GQ. Amanda, thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Still to come, the rise of elevator music started with a Michigan inventor.
The name Muzak, I mean, I think we sort of use that as a pejorative term.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
If you've ever been in an elevator, a shopping mall, a waiting room, or been put on hold, you have likely experienced the work of Michigander Major General George Owen Squire. And if that name doesn't ring a bell, perhaps this does. That's right. The much-loved and hated background music known as Muzak hails from our state. Here now to talk Michigan history with us is Mark Harvey of the Michigan History Center. Mark, where is General George Owen Squire from?
He's from Dryden, Michigan, out in Lapeer County in the Thumb area. And he grew up there and then went off to West Point and graduated and then got a PhD at Johns Hopkins University and rose through the ranks during World War I to become the top Signal Corps officer for. He had quite the military career.
Some people, I'm one of them, might not think that Muzak would have come from such a person. How did George Squire get started down the path of creating Muzak?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much the opposite image of a career military officer. But he was creative. He was essentially the person responsible for creating the aeronautics division in the Army. He was the first military passenger in a plane. He bought the first airplane from the Wright brothers for the United States Army. So he was an innovator. Hmm. He was also, you know, an experimenter, and he was intrigued with the idea of radio waves. He was part of the Signal Corps, so they're doing experimentation with how to better communicate among troops. So he's experimenting with radio waves and electricity. He actually co-invented the polarizing photo chronograph, which we know today as the radar gun. So the next time you get a speeding ticket, you can thank him for that.
So we have two things to thank him for.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
So he creates this way of delivering, transmitting music across electrical wires, but it took some time to work out the technical kinks, and by then it was the 1930s, and hello, we had the radio age. How did he compete with that?
Yeah, it's really an amazing thing to step back and think he was transmitting music through regular household electrical wires right into the house. To me, that seems actually more amazing than the radio waves. But they came up with that first, tested it on Staten Island in New York, and then radio just got rolling and sort of wiped out their business plan. But instead of just folding up their tent, they pitched it to businesses as sort of this prepackaged set of music, because radio, even though it was popular with advertisers and a unique way to communicate, you could have signal problems depending on weather and other things. So this was a more, especially for businesses, they didn't want people listening to staticky transmissions of music. They wanted it to be solid. So they figured out that business plan and sold it to mostly to businesses as prepackaged music for their offices and businesses.
So here you go, stores and restaurants and office buildings. We've got music for you. Where did Muzak get its music from?
They hired the top of the line studio musicians of the time. In fact, there was one excerpt where they were touting in their advertisement that they had the hottest harpist available. That really goes along with my concept of Muzak, though, right? The hottest harpist available. But they were session musicians, the same ones that you would probably find in Nashville now that are backing some of the biggest acts and names in music. But this paid, and it was a surging business, and they had cornered the market on it.
Wait, is it safe to say it really, really kind of evolved and took off in the 40s and 50s?
Yeah, and the name Muzak, I mean, I think we sort of use that as a pejorative term, but he liked the success in the name of Kodak so much that he just adapted that. He just tacked the ack onto the word, the name Muzak, and so that's where that name comes from. And then in the 40s, they really stepped it up to a different level. During war production, they took that idea of music in the workplace as a means of productivity. And they came up with this concept of stimulus progression is what they called it. And this was lots of company-based research that they could increase war production by feeding music to the workers in 15-minute segments. Hmm. And they would feed it to them for 15 minutes at the beginning of the day, slower music, maybe that hot harpist at the beginning of the day. And then they would take a break for 15 minutes so they didn't have listener fatigue. And then they'd come back for another 15 minutes of Muzak, and the music would increase in speed as they went along in the day. And the thought was, per their research, that it would increase the speed of production as well. And it really caught on.
We're going to take a quick listen now to the stimulus progression Muzak that was said to boost employee productivity. Is it true that even the White House was wired for Muzak, Mark?
Yeah, so Eisenhower brought it into the West Wing. LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, actually had a franchise of the Muzak company because they franchised it early on. He had the franchise in Texas, and so he brought it in. They even were purported to use it during NASA training to calm the astronauts as they trained for the lunar missions.
We certainly know that Muzak became known as elevator music, and it has kind of... It has certainly gone to beyond classic elevator music. We've seen them dipping into very popular hits, reworking them in its inimitable style. Here's a few examples of that. Thank you.
As time passed, Muzak seemed to be regarded with, shall we say, some disdain, and maybe that's an understatement, among baby boomers. In fact, am I right, during the 1980s, didn't another famous Michigander make an offer to buy the company just so he could shut it down?
Yes, our very own Ted Nugent tried to raise $10 million to just buy him out because he was just done with it. And I don't know if that's because they never used his music for Muzak or if he just really hated it. But his famous quote is, "Muzak's an evil force in today's society, causing people to lapse into uncontrollable fits of blandness." I think he was onto something.
I think maybe so. How is it doing today in the age of MP3s and online streaming services?
Interestingly, it's like the Muzak song that just won't end. It just keeps going. And they've gone through some different iterations and buyouts, but the brand Muzak is still alive and well today. They went through restructuring in 2009 where they talked about filing for bankruptcy, and then they were bought up by Mute Music. They still carry the Muzak brand, and they've really adapted with the times. They now license regular top 40 musicians and other genres of music, so they're not just doing the instrumentals, but they've updated their toolkit to meet the needs. So we just walked in the office here, and there was music piped in on the streets of Lansing, and we, you know, looked around and thought, wow, Muzak's right here now. It's in lots of towns and shopping centers still.
All because of General George Owen Squire of Dryden. Thank you so much. That's the Michigan History Center's Mark Harvey. Always great to have you stop by and share more Michigan history with us. And a tip of the hat to General Squire the next time we hear Muzak. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks, Cynthia.
The magic of theater is bringing audiences and performers together on so many levels. The themes of plays, actors, audiences coming together during a performance, each person bringing his or her life experiences and perceptions to the theater. And that performance space could be anything from a grand old theater to an open-air marketplace. All of this is coming together starting today through Sunday as the University of Michigan Center for World Performance Studies hosts the National Theater of Ghana. The centerpiece of this residency is a series of open-air performances of the Tennessee Williams play, 10 Blocks on the Camino Real. With us now, Kate Mendeloff, drama lecturer at U of M and director of Shakespeare in the Arb. Welcome back, Kate. Good to see you.
Oh, good to see you too, Cindy.
And we want to welcome from the National Theater of Ghana, we have artistic director and actor Mawuli Samova. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we have stage manager Agnes Panfred. Welcome to Michigan. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Kate, this series is part of the Provincetown Tennessee Williams Theater Festival.
Yes, this is a festival that I've been associated with artistically since its inception, which is about 12 years ago. The curator of the festival and the director of this production, David Kaplan, was a colleague of mine at Yale Drama School in the mid-70s. And we have been in touch, and he has been, contributed to my ideas, particularly about Tennessee Williams. And he is also extremely committed to working across cultures with international companies. And that's one thing I really admire him for. So he directed this production in Ghana, and it was performed in marketplaces in Ghana. And when he asked if I could sponsor a residency here in Michigan, I immediately thought, let's go to marketplaces.
Yeah, okay.
And I love outdoor theater, as you know, because of the Shakespeare. So this is something that I'm very excited about because we're going to reach a wide range of people.
With a play that is not well known. Tell us briefly about this play.
Well, the play was written in 1948, and it is the story of an American sailor named Kilroy who comes to a poor foreign town and is struggling to survive there and to keep his native optimism and, you could even say, his naivete alive in an environment where people are trying to take advantage of each other.
It's a one-act play. And Agnes, you've been performing this outdoors in Ghana and now doing the same while you're here in Southeast Michigan. Tell us a little about the role of the National Theater of Ghana in your country.
Well, the National Theater of Ghana has three resident groups. We have the drama company, we have the dance company, and we have the music company, that is the National Symphony Orchestra. Yeah, government pays us, and we propagate government policies, and we do that by using the local languages. I must say that Ghana, we have so many languages. We have 10 regions, and each region has about not less than 10 languages, so you can imagine. So we take these to the people, we go to them in the communities, and we make sure we use their language. So we take drama to them so they can really understand. That is what government wants to say about laws, rules, and then issues, I mean social issues in the community. You go to them, you study them, you do research, you see why they have those problems. At times they don't know why. So you put all this in the drama and you have solution at the end of the day.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Mawule, was it difficult material for you, do you think? This Southern American writer. I mean, or did you find immediately, were you able to grab on to things that you could say, yeah, that resonates with me, my experience?
I would say, what is not difficult in life? Everything in life is difficult, but it's the way you approach it. So, research. Turn the play inside out. Visit different communities and see how the communities can identify themselves with the production. Yeah. How can the people acquaint themselves, identify themselves with the situations in the play?
And you're trying to recreate the atmosphere of the Ghanaian marketplace as mm-hmm. as the troupe performs here in Michigan. So what are the performances going to be like?
We have a performance on the Diag of the University of Michigan off of State Street, and that is going to be at noon on Friday. That's a very busy place. People are walking to classes. People are, you know, moving through, and they're going to see these beautiful, colorful posters that are the backdrop for the play. They're going to see very colorfully dressed actors. They're going to hear very colorful and funny language, and hopefully they'll stop and they'll watch. Then we're also doing a performance at Depot Town in Ypsilanti on Saturday at 11. And then finally, the play is going to be done at CMAP, which is in Hamtramck. And I'm very excited because the company is also doing workshops with my students at the residential college, with students at the School of Theater at the Music School, and with the students of Mosaic Youth Theater.
That's going in Detroit. To be terrific.
Yeah.
What do you, Mawule and Agnes, what do you all hope that Michigan audiences will learn about Ghana through what you're going to be giving them through these performances?
Our style of acting, the way we speak, even our gestures, the kind of instruments we use. And then people will learn to know that at the end of the day, we all analyze and interpret and come to a common consensus. Permit me to use that expression, a common consensus, mm-hmm. you know, which theater is supposed to be bringing about, which will enhance cross cultures. And I'm sure people will be asking us the songs. Why did we sing this song? Why do we play this instrument all along? For instance, in the play originally, you have a guitar player, but the director decided to change it to the player of a drum or player of drums, which is it's also a musical instrument. And that is which that is something which is peculiar
yes.
with us Ghanaians, you know. And it's really going to preach a lot about how we also use our instruments and what we use them to achieve, you know,
yes.
as far as theater is concerned.
And Agnes, what do you hope audiences will take away from the message of this play, of this Tennessee Williams play?
Well, simply, there's no fairness in the world. The deal is rugged from the beginning to the end. Kilroy dies and his heart is even taken out. It was just then everybody realized that he had a heart of gold. So it's not been treated fairly. But that's how the world is. So with all this, we need to go through with a smile. That's it.
Well, it's exciting to have you in Southeast Michigan for this residency between now and Sunday. All the details and addresses of the performances of the National Theater of Ghana, while they're here now through Sunday, are at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. And we should note, there'll be a Q&A with the actors after the performances, and they're all free and open to everyone. Kate Mendeloff, University of Michigan, drama lecturer. And from the National Theater of Ghana, we've been talking with Agnes Panfred and Mawuli Samovo. Yes. Pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Oh, pleasure
to
be. Thank you very much. And hello to your wonderful listeners.
I hope to see you all.
Coming up, he lost his son Chase to suicide. Now a father reaches out to kids in schools all around the state.
I'm a father with a broken heart, that I have a Chase-sized hole inside of me.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Fewer teens are dying from accidents and disease, but teen deaths from suicide continue to rise. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for 15 to 24-year-olds. Jeff Edwards is on a mission to go into as many schools as possible and talk to as many kids as possible about mental health, depression, and suicide. Jeff Edwards is board chairman of the Southeast Michigan chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and he is here with us now. Jeff, welcome.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I would like to start out a little differently by having us get an idea of what your presentation is like and the kind of thing you're saying to youngsters when you go into schools.
I talk to them about scotomas, and scotomas are an ophthalmological term. It talks about an area of diminished vision within the visual field. But the layman's term is it's a blind spot. It's when you look at something and you don't see it. And so I sort of suggest to them that my hope is to perform sort of a virtual LASIK surgery on them to open their eyes up to things, to maybe help them to see things that they're not currently seeing, some things that are right in front of their face that they can't see. So I use a few examples of scotomas. Some of the classic ones are you looking at an image of an old woman? Are you looking at an image of a young woman? Do you see the head of a rabbit or do you see the head of a goose? So I try to get across the point that a lot of times we're looking at something right in front of us and we can't see it. And look at how revelational it is when somebody points it out to you. It's like, oh my goodness, there it is. I've saw it the whole time. Why didn't I see it? And the idea that sometimes we're looking at a problem that doesn't look like it has any solution to it, that we don't have the ability to solve. And we start feeling bad about ourselves when we don't have the ability to be able to solve this problem. But that what we miss is that very often we're not equipped to solve the problem on our own because we are human beings with inherent limitations. We're not, you know, some, you know, supreme being that has all the answers to all the questions before they're even posed. We're all lacking in information. So sometimes rather than trying to solve a problem ourselves, what we need to realize is that the ability to solve a problem is in recognizing that we can't solve it and that you need to find somebody who does know how to solve the problem, an expert in that area. And so you don't always have to do it on your own. You can unburden yourself in doing that. And you're not a bad person if you can't solve that problem on your own. I then show them some images of a boy, and I ask them what they're looking at when they see that. And they have all kinds of answers. He's, you know, seems happy, smiling, he's active, he's doing the things that he's doing. But then I ask them, well, what are you looking at when you look at him that you can't see? What I reveal is what they can't see is that he's dead and that he was a victim of suicide. I then ask them to look at me and ask them what they see. Mm. And I qualify by saying, hey, I realize I could stand to be in better shape and lose some weight and my hair is, you know, not as dark and thick as it used to be and I didn't wear glasses. But then I ask them, what don't you notice? What don't you see? What they don't see is that I'm a father with a broken heart, that I have a Chase-sized hole inside of me. You know, what they don't see is how I react when I drive by a Chase Bank sign or when I receive email or voicemail messages that say, you have a very important message from Chase because I have a Chase credit card. Or, you know, what they don't see is how badly I would love to be able to just buy a pair of tickets to anything to take him to, you know, because I'm never, ever going to get that opportunity.
Chase was 12.
Yes.
And that was in 2003 when he died by suicide.
Yes.
So he was in middle school, right?
Yes.
Do I understand he was not, you know, certainly from what the kids are telling you as they look at pictures of Chase, this is not the type of kid that one has kind of as an image of someone struggling with depression and mental
No, he was just the opposite. You know, he was active and well-liked and popular and, I mean, we're partial, but handsome. He was artistic. He was funny. He was compassionate. He always had, you know, the comments that came back, he always had your back. He was always the champion of the underdog. He was the type of kid that, you know, the mainstreamed handicapped kids would invite to their birthday parties. You know, I mean, he was just a loving, sweet boy. And he was so antithetical to what it was that you would have anticipated at the time.
The assumptions. Those assumptions.
Right, just the stereotypes, you know, the moody, you know, the picked on, the bullied kid. I mean, just all the stereotypes that come to mind. It's those stereotypes that deceive people into believing what they're looking at is something other than what it could potentially be.
After it happened, you know, retrospect, did anything come together where you had that terrible hindsight and went, ah, or any clues, anything?
Initially, no. What does a 12-year-old have to be so depressed about that they resort to taking their own life? You know, that's, you think maybe teenagers, forlorn love, you know, Romeo and Juliet syndrome. What is a 12-year-old? You know, so we didn't know that much about it. And we had actually had conversations with him about someone who had taken their life months before and how, you know, things are never so bad to have to do something like that. So the more we investigated it, the more we came to realize that unlike learning about the birds and the bees or alcohol or drugs or any of those kinds of health-related issues, that when it came to really important life-threatening kinds of things like mental illness, youth depression, pre-suicidal behavior, that no one was equipped to know about it. And that just didn't make sense to us. As we learned later on what those warning signs were, you know, tragically, we saw that Chase had every single one of them.
Such as?
Well, things like oversleeping or having disruptions in his sleep patterns. It's an inability to sleep. You know, he would come in the evening. It'd be, you know, 9 o'clock, 9:30 on a school night. We would say, well, what are you doing up? It's like, well, I can't sleep, Dad. Well, it's a school night. You need to go back to bed. Well, I can't sleep. Well, you know, maybe eating chocolate or drinking caffeinated cola later in the day can keep
you up. Typical parent answer.
Yeah.
You
know? And then after Chase died, some of the email messages that we would receive would say things like, Chase, I used to think it was so funny the way you would sleep on the bus on the way to school. Now, how does a parent know their kid's sleeping on the bus? Does the bus driver see that? No, the other kids on the bus see it. But if they don't know what they're looking at, then it just looks like funny kids sleeping on the bus. Chase used to go to a rollerblading skate park near our house, and he'd say, Dad, watch, I'm going to go down this big ramp, I'm going to do a 720, and I'm going to land it going down another ramp. He never could do it. He would always crash and burn. And what would we say to him? Chase, what are you, nuts? You're going to kill yourself doing something like that. Reckless, self-destructive, risk-taking behavior. Mm-hmm. I mean, these things that very closely mimic normalcy if we don't know what it is that we're looking at, right?
Again, just as you talk about that image of the old woman and the young woman in the same thing, you have to look with different eyes.
Right.
And I know that you worked very closely with former State Representative Chris Ward to draft and pass the Chase Edwards Law. And this law encourages public school districts and academies to provide what's called age-appropriate instruction for students and also training for teachers about the warning signs and the risk factors. In your experience, is this something schools want to do?
My personal experience is no. It's something that they are reluctant to talk about because they still subscribe to a lot of the antiquated misinformation and myths that exist out there. Like, if you talk about it, you're going to put ideas in kids' heads and they're going to go out and do it. Quite frankly, there was the chairman of the State Senate Education Committee. That was their primary concern that they expressed to me when the law came to that side of the house. But I was able to get my hands on some research, compliments of Dr. Cheryl King from University of Michigan, that substantiates the fact that you don't make kids go out and take their own life by talking about it any more than you give them cancer by talking about it. And once we provided him with that information, it streamlined right through the legislative process and was voted on in unanimity. There was not one dissenting vote. Everybody, it was a no-brainer that they voted on it and for it, as did the governor in signing it. But the kicker was, is that in Michigan, we cannot mandate curriculum. You can't tell schools what to teach. It's up to them. And so the Michigan Department of Education provides model curriculum outlines so that school systems don't have to reinvent the wheel. But those school systems don't have to employ it 100%. They can cherry pick it.
Well, they even says in the law, I've got it here, failure of a school district or any public school academy to comply does not create a cause of action or constitute a breach of any legal duty. So they're just saying, if you want to do it. It's a gentle suggestion.
Right.
This is the kind of law, I've got to wonder, that makes a legislator feel good. Look, we've tackled this.
Oh, yeah. We've got this wonderful framed photo of us with the governor and a copy of the law with Chase's name highlighted on it and the pen framed as well that she used to sign it. But we didn't delude ourselves. You know, in many ways, this is a symbolic law. It's not a substantive law. It's a law without teeth. It's like having to do your taxes, but there being no April 15th. You know, are you ever going to get them done? There's nothing that holds people to any standard or a level of accountability for teaching about this.
And do you envision any way of bolstering Chase's law to be able to put more teeth to it?
Well, where the bolstering would be, and this is what we're working toward currently, would be like, you know, exists for subjects like bullying, that teachers and counseling staffs, as part of their professional development and ongoing training and education, that there be requirements that they, within a reasonable amount of time, should go through some training to familiarize them with the warning signs so that if it's quacking and waddling and swimming and laying eggs and flying south once a year, they recognize it for what it is.
So you can mandate teacher training. Can't mandate curriculum.
That's one of the approaches. And, you know, there's a lot of states that already have this in place. So we're not looking for Michigan to reinvent the wheel here. And so, unfortunately, too many schools wait for a tragedy to happen before they wake up to the fact that they have a problem with mental illness and suicide. But once it happens, then they're frightened that there's going to be contagion, that kids are just going to start dropping like dominoes from this stuff. So they want to let it settle down and quiet because we, quote unquote, don't typically have this kind of thing happen in this area. When I field some of these calls, it's like I want to reach through the phone and grab these people by the lapel and go, what are you talking about? It just did. So then they wait, but then they leave all of these grieving kids struggling, trying to figure out why this person did it on their own without more proactively controlling the dialogue and providing them with the right kinds of information to begin with.
Which is what you're trying to do as you go into to talk to schools, because the first line of defense starts with the kids sitting next to that youngster in the school bus or in the classroom.
Because they're going to talk to each other way before they're going to talk to adults about it. And so what I encourage these kids to do is to start their own social epidemic of making it okay to talk about. You know, we're not asking them to find a cure for cancer or to lower the crime rate in their area. What we're asking them to do is just make it okay if they're feeling bad to talk about, because this is not a flaw in character that we've far too long made it out to be. It's more a flaw in chemistry. This is not a mood. This is a malady. This is a medical condition. If they were broken, bleeding, feverish, or swollen, their parents would have them into the doctor yesterday for this stuff. So why is this any different? You know, contrary to popular opinion, there are 350 million plus Americans that don't just get sick from their neck down. You can get sick from your neck up. So that's what we're trying to make them aware of.
Has this helped you heal?
It has. We often say that when people are about to die, that they have a life review, like their entire life passes before them. But I can tell you that when you are a parent that has lost a child to suicide, every wrong thing you ever said or did plays back to you. I mean, it's unbelievable the minutiae that comes to mind of the things you shouldn't have said or how you handled things or mishandled things. And it's very, very tough to find the road to forgiveness, self-forgiveness, when it comes to those kinds of things. Because as a parent, you're supposed to protect your kid. To have allowed something to happen in your own home is unconscionable. But what we've come to realize is that all of these kids are our kids. And the comparative that I use is, how do we typically, or how does a school typically handle an attempted abduction outside of a school? A lot of people find out about it, right? Yeah. They send notes home, local law enforcement, parents, teachers.
Yeah.
Within 24 hours, it's on all the local media. It's on their websites. They have composite drawings of the perpetrator and photographs of the type of vehicle he drove. The reason people take it seriously is because, God forbid, it could happen again or it could happen to my kid. When the cold, hard reality is, there's a far, far greater probability that someone's kid is going to suffer mental illness, one in four kids by the time they're 18 will, that they're going to have dark thoughts, with a great percentage of schools having kids who have already attempted. Nearly 2% of a school's population, both middle and high school, have kids who have already attempted. Not going to attempt. They already have. So there's a far greater probability that someone's kid could fall victim to this than ever is the prospect of them being abducted. But yet it would be akin to a school who had an attempted abduction saying to the community, you know, we're really not going to talk about this because we don't want to upset anybody. And God forbid, we don't want any kids going out and getting abducted. So let's just keep our fingers crossed that this doesn't happen again. And if they handle an attempted abduction that way, there'd be some answering to do. I, on the other hand, I'm someone who have seen this perpetrator. I know his MO. I know the vehicle he shows up in. I know his disguises. And all I'm trying to do is to let you know what this villain looks like and acts like and what insidious methods he employs. Why wouldn't people want to know that, right? Then the school systems that, in my view, are doing it properly, they have me come in every semester. I'll come in 3 times a year and talk to every single middle school health student. Or I will come in to every 9th grade health class or theology class and talk to all of those kids. And so they know every person has been exposed to this. And, you know, it isn't foolproof. There are still kids who have heard me speak that years later have, you know, resorted to ending their own life tragically. But I do have enough instances where people have provided me feedback to say, their kid realized that they weren't a bad person, that they were just sick and they needed to talk to a doctor, and now they are. And nothing could be more gratifying to me.
Well, it's certainly a mission that really does not have an end. And you can reach Jeff Edwards by emailing him, jeffhashope@gmail.com. Jeff Edwards, thank you so much for sharing your work and your story with us on Stateside.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. And one quick note, today's show featured some interviews that did air earlier this year on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.